chains that bind me, won't you release me, set me free? Bring him back to me, oh, melancholy moon.
Gangs up in an old parlor game, but strictly on the jive side. Pussy in the corner.
Thank you.
Teddy Powell is a composer as well as a conductor, and here is Jimmy Blair with Teddy's new ballad hit, It's All Over Town.
My friends all pass me by, can't look me in the eye. They say I've been a fool for loving you. Am I an old desire? It's all over town, we're through. They say that you're unkind. Good love have made me blind. My heart won't let my mind believe it's true. Yet where there's smoke, there's fire. It's all over town, we're through. I don't mind joining the souvenirs that you put away on your shelf. But if my love dreams must end in tears, then you'll have to tell me yourself. We've never said goodbye. Let's prove it's all a lie. Let's keep that wedding date we planned for two and end this idle gossip. It's all over town, we're
is bringing you the music of America's newest dance sensation, Teddy Powell and his orchestra, coming to you from the famous door on 52nd Street in New York City. It's an old tune, but then it's a Teddy Powell arrangement, I Found a New Baby. Thank you. Jimmy Blair sings with Teddy Powell and the orchestra for you, to you. It's supercharged jive with Aunt Paul Power and Ruth Gaylor sings. Well, all right.
Hello, Joe. What do you know?
I just got back from a vaudeville show.
Take a dance, take a chance.
Well, okay, let it go. Well, all right.
Well, all right.
Dig, 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 well, all right.
All right.
Chop, 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 well, all right.
All right.
Ahoy, ahoy, well, all right, for tonight is a night to be bright. The music don't do you, you know, tonight's the night. Oh, we're going. Don't know where we'll go, but we're going. Yes, we're going. The only thing I know is we're going. Feel the rhythm running through you, you know, tonight's the night. Well, all right. Dig, 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 well, all right. jump, 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 well, all right. Hi, 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 well, all right, well, all right, well, all right, well, all right. The music's on, do you, you know, tonight, the night.
Jimmy Blair in the spotlight, and it's that old favorite, the Chinese lullaby. is all for the music of one of America's youngest composers and conductors, Teddy Powell and his orchestra, from the famous Door on 52nd Street in New York City. John Harper speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
O'clock, midnight. WJSB, Washington.
Airing on Asheville FM, 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week, we're sharing an interview with Will Gillis, author of the recently published book, Did the Science Wars Take Place? The Political and Ethical Stakes of Radical Realism, published by C4SS, where Gillis holds the position of the Volterine de Clare Chair of Centrifugal Studies and Technical Coordinator. For the hour, we talk about the so-called science wars of the 1990s, debates involving scientific approaches and shared understandings of a measurable physical reality, postmodernism, the roles leftists and anarchists played in the debates, and how cults and authoritarianism employ anti-realist explanations of the world to limit their subjects' moves towards liberation. You can read more of Gillis's writings at humaniterations.net or c4ss.org, and check our show notes for links for further reading.
My name is William Gillis. I write for a variety of different outlets, but prominently among them, the Center for Stateless Society, and I use they/them pronouns.
Thank you very much for being willing to have this chat with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This is really great.
So, William, for the audience, William recently released their first book via C4SS entitled Did the Science Wars Take Place? The Political and Ethical Stakes of Radical Realism. Congratulations on this.
Thank you.
So before we get into the book, I'd appreciate if you wouldn't mind saying a few things about C4SS and the ideas that that project supports.
Yeah, so the Center for Stateless Society is a media center and publishing project for left-market anarchists like mutualists, roughly anarchists who are committed to egalitarian and the destruction of capitalism in the sense of bosses, classes, poverty, corporations, etc., but who make a distinction between that and markets, that is to say, like voluntary trade networks. Markets have a long existence. They've been in virtually every society or culture, including relatively egalitarian ones. Think women selling vegetables in the village square, traders and tinkerers wheeling their wares around. But capitalism is a recent creation whereby immense coordinated violence was used to dispossess huge amounts of people, giving them no choice but to slave under a boss. And capitalism depends upon constant violent intervention in a host of ways to not just keep those workers dispossessed, but to stop market competition from eroding wealth, since there are dramatic economic inefficiencies, actually, that are inherent to corporations and billionaires or even tyrannical bosses in small businesses. So left market anarchists, like those of us at C4SS, analyze the world and the myriad ways in which markets are constantly being suppressed in it. Think of the murders of Eric Garner or Mohamed Bouazizi to keep capitalism and the rich afloat. So we've been a part of the anarchist movement since its inception. Left market anarchists have been. It was market anarchist Dyer D. Lum who smuggled Louis Ling his dynamite in Chicago. And it was a market anarchist who saved and compiled the largest collection of anarchist materials in North America, the Lobby Day collection. Unfortunately, there's a nasty movement that formed in the 1950s called anarcho-capitalism that tries to appropriate from us while defending pretty much every hierarchy in existence. So much of what the Center for Stateless Society does is critique those people and try to make them see the light, sometimes by turning back their own arguments on them. And this means that we attract both regular anarchists who have become convinced that some form of markets are necessary for coordination and that hawking books at a book fair isn't some deep sin. And we attract former right libertarians who've been convinced to more consistently oppose domination. This is perhaps unfortunate in some sense, because as we've converted people out of right libertarianism, those who remain have become much worse on average.
But you can't be blamed for that. So,
well, I blame myself.
to move on to the book, could you give a synopsis of the term science wars, what it colloquially describes, the tensions between the sciences and the run-up, and some of the provocateurs that listeners might be familiar with?
Yeah. So the science wars is remembered by many as a conflict in the 1990s between academics that spilled over into mainstream discourse and media, mostly over a famous hoax article that a Marxist physicist named Alan Sokal got published in a Marxist zine called Social Text. The article denied that any physical reality existed, asserting that matter is just something that we make up and that all that exists are social relations, and it endlessly cited things that a specific Marxist writer, Stanley Aronowitz, who was an editor at Social Text, had written that were false, ignorant, or bad, while heaping praise on him. Aronowitz, he had been dallying with a movement called postmodernism that was kind of half academic and half subcultural. A handful of people in the United States, primarily around a guy named Lotinger at Columbia University in New York, had started translating and republishing some French philosophers and circulating them in zines. This caught on in no small part thanks to the NAMBLA theorist collaborating with the Shah in Iran and supposed chaos magician Peter Lamborn Wilson, who also went by Hakim Bey. But like across the board on the left at this time, there was a certain understandable hostility to the institutional, like scientific world and its complicity with the military-industrial complex and the monolithic cultural infrastructural mega machine that countries like the United States were turning into. Many leaped onto a rather reductive critique of fascism as totalitarianism that had the benefit of also applying to the US and USSR. So there was a sense in which scientific models like that of gravity were considered totalizing. That is to say, they attempted to speak universally. And there was this fear that such universality was somehow the same thing as imperialism and fascism. So there was a lot of interest by the hippies, basically, in mysticism, faith healing, quackery, whatever, to push back against science. And thus, Aronowitz had written a book called Science as Power that rather hilariously misrepresented a bunch of science and philosophy, but also followed a narrative that was popular in the left at the time. Aronowitz was motivated by trying to save components of Marxism like teleology, which basically in this context means the notion that aggregate things have an internal intended character or destiny that is more or less or more powerful than the nature of their constituent parts. And he was trying to defend that from physics, which disproves that sort of thing. Similarly, Lamborn Wilson was trying to legitimize chaos magic and quote unquote violating boundaries by appealing to philosophers like the post-structuralist Lyotard, who had endorsed a return to paganism in a certain sense, and Paul Feyerabend, who had defended faith healing and praised Mao enslaving and murdering scientists, saying that the same should be done in the West. And what's important to note is that long before this intra-Marxist conflict and this big academic, you know, public media show, there was, you know, anarchists, feminists, and anti-fascists, and myriad other leftists were often quite critical of postmodernists and the jumble of arguments or positions often found among them. So, you know, this was anarchists and feminists heckling and critiquing French post-structuralists when they came to New York in the mid-1970s, but it also included figures as diverse as John Zerzan and Murray Bookchin writing lengthy critiques. And of course, there were raging conflicts in academic philosophy during this time too. But after Sokal's hoax brought these arguments to public mass media kind of attention, a bunch of right-wing demagogues treated Sokal like a champion, and much of the leftist humanities and academia closed ranks around postmodernism, with both sides rewriting the history ever since then, while constantly appealing to it, especially like now, despite it being, you know, almost three decades on. And famously, Jordan Peterson accuses anyone and everyone of being a postmodernist while never having read a single thing from it.
When reading this book, initially, I found myself really conflicted around what I was reading in terms of the influence on postmodernism and this totalizing area, like idea of the world. It's kind of funny, like I can see like Zerzan critiques postmodernism frequently, however, also pushes back on the idea of a universal existence, right? Or like, we'll talk about the stories that are told by the mega machine or whatever as this totalizing imposition. Can you break down a little bit, unless we do this a little bit later in a different question, but like the sort of tension between the idea of this totalizing critique and the maybe some of the good-natured anti-imperialist approach towards like reflecting on Western like Eurocentric stories of the world. For instance, like, yeah, like my sister was talking to me about her realization that the term Middle East is kind of a screwed up term for a region because it definitely centers, centers experience from the UK, looking in this direction in terms of how far the empire reached. I don't know, that's kind of a weird example maybe, but like, let me drop this and I'll try to return to it later in a different way.
Does okay.
That, yeah.
That's totally fine. I mean, I think the term totalitarian gets used in a lot of different ways. And one of the things I wanted to draw out really early on in the book was the ways in which it was being thrown at anarchists mm-hmm. in ways that are perhaps like obviously unfair. And going off of that, once that's recognized, being like, oh, well, there are other instances where this is being thrown at like scientific models of reality that are likewise unfair, mm-hmm. where, you know, the things that we want to critique with critiques of totalitarianism, one, I mean, maybe we can get into this later, but totalitarianism maybe isn't the best understanding of fascism as a movement, but it is certainly the case that there are, you know, imperialist universalist tendencies, settler colonialism, Christianity, what have you, that want to impose like a single perspective upon the world. But, you know, when anarchism is totalizing in a certain sense and our rejection of domination, that got us critiqued or attacked by Marxists who were themselves pro the state and gulags. So individuals who were particularly authoritarian would say that anarchists were the real totalitarians because we didn't allow for there to be any space for domination left. And so I think we have to be like very careful about what we think of as, or what we're critiquing and what we think of as like the enemy or the you know, the thing that we're working against. And I'm not unsympathetic to many of the currents within, especially like decolonial tendencies. I mean, not unsympathetic, but very sympathetic. But at the same time, there's limits to certain things where an approach that one had maybe breaks down a little and it becomes necessary to say like, oh, what did we actually mean here when we're using these words? This word kind of sounds like this word, or this use case of it kind of rhymes with this other use case, but are they really the same thing? Are we really like poking at the same thing here? And that isn't to say that I don't think it's super critical that we, you know, critique actually existing science as a social practice or a set of institutions. Science kind of sometimes, the phrase operates as this near mythical symbol of authority mm-hmm. that's constantly being appealed to by bureaucrats and reactionaries. But at the same time, it's productive to talk of science as a way of thinking mm-hmm. or as like a set of desires or motivations. Liberal critics of science will often argue that we can't let pursuit of the world be done for its own sake. And Well, they'll say that it's like, it's critical that we like enslave scientists under the signifier of democracy or social control to make sure that we only learn things that are useful for making widgets or curing diseases, and whatever is voted on is the most important. Mm-hmm. But there's an explosion of inquisition or desire in a lot of children, and those that survive beatings under the education system yep. long enough become scientists. And I think this should be pursued as an end in itself. And that's a very like totalizing or universalistic kind of like thinking process, the process towards trying to understand everything, trying to go further, to not be tied down to parochial, like local context or specific context. And I think that can be cast in a certain way as totalizing or totalitarian or universalist or imperialistic, but it's very, and it can, and can sometimes be, and it can sometimes be utilized as a cover for immense violence, dispossession, oppression, but it doesn't have to be. And it's critical that we like think very clearly about what is actually going on and not get like these things conflated.
I mean, I'm critical of the term. Like, totalitarianism was brandished after World War II in a lot of ways by reactionary forces that could no longer talk about themselves as being pro-fascist, but they could talk about communism as being a totalizing system, like mm-hmm. state communism. And it became in the vogue to say, look at these two systems. They're the same. Any question of, you know, challenging, and therefore, you know, slippery slope, any challenge towards the idea of like concentration of private property and class society and anything that we've got right now, this society that beat fascism and fought off communism is like leaning towards totalitarianism. Like, yeah, I wasn't so much meaning to jab at that. I was just trying to find a way to sort of play with that idea a little bit.
Yeah, and it's a recurring tendency, right? And I think it's hard to extract anything else that's said or that one would talk about in terms of the book from that topic, because postmodernism itself, I think, at least as I start talking about it, like centered on that narrative of we're resisting the totality, right? And it became like this kind of core, one of the core components. And so everything else kind of like flows around this question of like, is this actually totalizing in a bad sense? What does that mean? Like, are there appropriate times when you can speak of universalities? Are there inappropriate times, etc.?
Well, maybe this would be a good time to actually introduce that question about like definitions. Would you mind talking about postmodernism as an idea or as a framework, how it developed, as it's used by various parties, because it's used differently by different people as a term, to the point that, you know, Jordan Peterson, as you mentioned, will like use it as a slur. I've heard other philosophers use it as a slur. But there's other terms that you bring up in the book, radical realism and anti-realism, that figure heavily into the way that map the arguments as they proceed throughout, like in the run-up to the quote-unquote science wars and up until today.
Yeah, so I mean, postmodernism is notoriously nebulous as a term, and it's more like a cluster identification in the sense that it's kind of like these people with some common associations and some common perspectives. And I think that's fair to do with some terms and with some movements and circles of people, but it means that as a consequence, it's abused a lot, especially by the right. You know, Jordan Peterson will say that anarchists are postmodernists because we're egalitarian and anti-authoritarian, or that all queer and trans people are postmodernists. And then other people will accuse anyone who's arguing irrationally of being a postmodernist by virtue of having argued irrationally. So in that sense, it's operating as a slur without a lot of depth. And it's understandable that I think many people go, oh, okay, if the term doesn't mean actually anything and you want to call me that, fine, okay, whatever. But you know, I would argue, and I argue quite strongly in the book, that postmodernism is an actual movement or milieu that did exist, especially in the 1980s, however distributed, where people self-identified with that label. And even if many of the original post-structuralist thinkers in France didn't identify with it as an ideological flag, it became one. So in my book, I trace like this loose milieu of people and the set of perspectives that were common among them. And I highlight, as I said, like this totalitarianism analysis, whereby fascism is seen as a universalizing impulse. And in response, you can kind of see postmodernism as this like, well, okay, if fascism is totalizing, then we have to be everything that's not totalizing. So it becomes this reactive embrace of values like particularity, difference, plurality, transgression, illegibility, and humility. All of those can be totally fine or good in some contexts. But when those values or those words get fetishized as like core unassailable goods, like, you know, evaluate the situation, what creates more illegibility? Whatever does is therefore better, right? Like that doesn't work. And taken as ends to themselves, they can be taken to very reactionary conclusions. And I want to say, like, as with any movement or ideology, there's variation. Like, not every postmodernist would embrace everything there. And that said, though, there's like it's common overlap. Like, it's things that you find as like recurring currents. And I think this is true of like any ideological or subcultural space. Libertarianism, liberalism, anarchism. I would hope in anarchism, everyone agrees that domination is wrong. But if you go to like libertarianism or neoliberalism, it's a cluster concept. There's a variety of different things that people believe in, and not everyone believes in every one of those things, but they all kind of, and not everyone associates with everyone else, but they all kind of associate with each other. And they all kind of like mostly like cluster around the same things. So it's very hazy, and that's, you know, imperfect in some ways, but it's just inherent to being able to describe social movements and like currents in society. Anti-realism exists within this cluster of values as one of the core ones or one of the like most reemergent ones. And it was very important to the science wars, but not every postmodernist was anti-realist. So anti-realism versus realism is the central topic of my book. And also, these are like very technical terms in philosophy with many slightly varying uses. And they're not like terms of abuse necessarily, although people can use them as terms of abuse. I don't like anti-realism, but there are philosophers who quite strongly self-identify as anti-realists. And there are philosophers who, well, you know, of either side, who will use the term anti-realism and realism. So it has a very technical sense, although those technical definitions will go in different directions. I should define what they are. So broadly, realism is the stance that there's a single reality with some universal structure that we can figure out and model to at least some degree. And anti-realism basically says, nah, about varying aspects of that, right? So there's, as a consequence, you know, as I said, like lots of versions. And in the book, I laboriously go through them in part to show that different versions of anti-realism or different arguments often opportunistically jump between one another. So someone will be making one argument in one style of anti-realism, and then will slip into a different style of anti-realism in order to avoid an attack upon that one, right? And then slip back when they need to. Yeah. And, oh, I also make this distinction between radical realism and fundamentalist realism. And in that case, they're mostly my chosen terms, although there are a few individuals who have used either phrase. Radical realism is the notion that the structures of the universe are under no obligation to be easily knowable by some random primates like us, right? You know, so we have to work very hard to delve under appearances to what simplifications are useful to us, or underneath those simplifications to find what's a true universal root dynamic. But it may be like very alien, and it means sometimes discarding what turns out to just be like a sloppy rule of thumb that we imposed upon the world and that isn't actually universal in the world. Fundamentalist realism, on the other hand, asserts that we can know reality. Well, I mean, all forms of realism assert that to some extent, but that we already do. And it's kind of simple that appearances and common sense are likely to be true with only some minor corrections. This is sometimes called naive realism in the populist literature, but there's a lot of different variations of it that I wanted to kind of group together pretty implicitly in the book to save space and show how there's a common like impulse driving that.
There is an interesting point that you make, and I'm full disclosure, I am not a scientist. I do not knowingly practice or am trained in any sciences, not because you all are witch burners, but just, you know, because it's just not where I focus my attention. But I find it really fascinating, and I'd love to learn more or get into the practice. But one thing that you return to, I think, throughout the book in terms of the idea of reality, and I want to ask more questions about the concept of science, but just to sort of touch on a thing, simplicity with the fundamentalist realists is something that is like the world is present. The world is actually simple to understand in that vision. But there is like a value to simplification that you express, and I think it's from your physicist background, or maybe just from a scientific background, because I guess mathematicians talk about it a lot, but the idea of lossless reducibility in understanding the universe or how reality is constructed. And I know there's a question later on that talks about this. I'm familiar with this term from exporting audio basically on computers or graphics. There's smaller images or smaller audio files that may to our ears or our eyes seem like pretty full of depth are oftentimes a reduced version of those initial files, those initial raw recordings that, you know, if you have the ability to delve in or listen with an exceptionally good set of ears or a set of headphones, you might notice pops and cracks or like background noises from a couple streets down or whatever in that raw, lossless version. The lossy version is something that's easy to spread around. Can you talk about just the idea among realists of simplicity and this ideal of lossless compression or compression?
Yeah, so among realists, especially in formal philosophy, lossless compression and simplicity kind of has a bad name. That's not true for all of them, and they're significant holdouts. But among physicists, especially the people who were involved in the science wars, a lot of them were leftist-y physicists of some kind who were critiquing the more postmodern and relativist side of things. For those folks, and in the physics community, lossless reduction, lossless compression is incredibly valuable. And people will maybe not use exactly those words for it, but very similar ones in a variety of different ways all the time to talk about like, what is the thing that we're pursuing? And the thing that we find is like proof that we've like successfully achieved, you know, a correct model of things. And I think it was important to me to go in depth with like physics examples in the book and put equations in on one page. I promise they're short equations. You don't have to read them. And they're simple math. But even though my editor was very unhappy with the with the equations, because no one wants to read those.
For aesthetic reasons. Okay.
I thought it was important to go into that in part because the experience of certain realms of core science, what I would call the radical sciences, is so different from everyday human experience and the intuitions that we build up. there is no such thing as lossless compression in everyday human life. It does not exist. If you take an audio file and you compress it, you lose something. But what if you could take an audio file and compress it and then uncompress it and you would not have lost anything? And that's what you can do in some instances, in some radical sciences and math. And in some sense, all of science, well, especially those in the natural sciences, are striving for some degree of at least less lossy compression. And that, like, an effective model of reality is a model of reality that manages to compress, to take everything that we know and create a compression that doesn't actually lose anything, that makes it easier for us to, like, you know, visualize, engage with, work with, state, even if it's not necessarily work with, because it can be incredibly hard to work with, but, like, find some way to compress it that can be uncompressed into everything without loss of anything. And of course, that's over a domain, over a specific thing. And the difference ends up playing out on whether or not you're evaluating a macroscopic system like humans. I mean, we're much, much larger than a microscopic system, right? So there's countless particles all involved in all these countless things like our brains. There's all these infinite, basically, connections and relations and processing that's happening. And if you had a computer that could model everything and take the actual the physics of it and then put in the core physics, you could build out the whole system and you could watch the whole system. At least that's the reductionist, lossless reductionist account. It is impossible to do in practice because we have limitations in computation. We have limitations in storage of things. But there are things that, like electromagnetism, you have electromagnetism plays this role. It has all these different features, all these different things around the world, all kind of share a same.
A very topical joke. This is called 100 Years.
Something in the air is made to just shine.